This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last week was the projection of one's own failure onto a competitor. And we talked about two examples where that happened, where the failure of an individual was projected, the blame for the failure was projected onto a competitor. The first case was Cain and Abel. And we looked at the case where Cain innovated sacrifice. Nobody taught him the principle, he developed it on and of his own. He innovated sacrifice, and we discussed that an innovator has the advantage of being the only one in the market, and therefore quality is not an issue. Because whatever he produces is of superior quality than anything else available in the market, because there is nothing else available in the market. So being an innovator has a certain danger. The danger is complacency. The danger is, I innovated. The danger is the lack of recognition that within seconds of that innovation, the innovation will be imitated and improved upon, which is exactly what Hevel did. Hevel, his brother, Abel, sees the sacrifice, says that's a good thing to be doing, and does it better than Cain. God accepts Abel's sacrifice and rejects Cain's sacrifice. Cain blames the competitor. You stole my idea. And if you didn't bring a sacrifice, mine would have been accepted. The only reason mine wasn't accepted, because next to yours, mine looks stupid. But the fact was that had you not come into the market at the same time that I did, God would have taken mine. That's not true. The fact is God rejected Cain's sacrifice because the quality just wasn't good enough. And he would have rejected it even if it was the only sacrifice. But Cain was unable to see that. The tendency is to blame the competitor. The tendency is to blame the imitator. And we talked about the fact that there is also a tendency in innovation to be mean, to be small-minded, keep it to oneself. And when one is imitating, there is a generosity. One can talk of abundance when one has nothing new. Because there is nothing really valuable. So one can talk about giving things away when one has not innovated. The innovator tends not to give things away. The imitator tends to be quite generous. And we talked about the fact that when sacrifices are introduced as a mitzvah in Vayikra, in the book of Leviticus, it's introduced as Odom ki yakriv mikem korban. We spoke about the Kayakra's idea, that that means when you bring a sacrifice, bring it from within yourself and bring it like Adam brought it. Adam also brought a sacrifice. He too innovated, but his was generous. There was quality in his sacrifice. There was abundance in his sacrifice. So Adam got it right. In Adam's case, it was a sacrifice. He didn't imitate the idea, he generated the idea, and he generated it in great abundance and very great quality. Whereas in Cain and Abel, Cain's sacrifice was an innovation, but it was mean. Abel's sacrifice was generous, but it was imitation. And the Torah indicates to us, make your sacrifices, invest, make your moves like Adam made his moves, from within yourself, Mikem, from within yourself, your own idea, your own thinking, but be generous with it. Be magnificent in the quality that you produce. And the second example that we had was the example of, in our case, of Shaul and David, where we pointed out that God put in an evil spirit into Shaul, and we questioned, if God put the evil spirit into Shaul, then it's not his fault. Then how can he be held responsible? Is this what God does? Did he then put bad spirits in us? Does he depress us? When we are depressed, is that an act of God? And can we say, I am depressed, that's why I do nothing with my life? And could Shaul say that? No, we tracked down Shaul made one decision of his own which led to the depression. Once he had made that decision, God made him depressed. But the depression that God infused into him was caused by a choice that he made. And the choice was that he was eyeing as David. He started eyeing David meanly. He chose to look at David as the cause of his problems. And we pointed out that the way that that's spelt in the Tanakh is Ovein, Ayin Vav Mem, which comes from the word Avon, which means a sin. That was his sin, that was his only sin in this episode. What he did was he chose to blame his competitor for his downfall. And the truth is, even if David wasn't in the picture at all, his downfall was before that. What could Shaul have done? How could the story have developed differently? Had Shaul said, I am the problem. The reason I've been rejected is not because there's somebody better than me. There is somebody better than me because I failed. And he would have worked on his flaw. Shaul would have been the hero. He wouldn't have recovered his kingdom. He wouldn't have displaced Dodi. That was already decided. That he would have gone down in history as an unblemished hero. The reason he was not the hero that he could have been, as great as Shaul was, and in our analysis of Shaul, and particularly in today's analysis of him, we must bear that in mind. We're dealing with a very great man who remained a very great man. Yet, there was the flaw. And what was the flaw? That he didn't wait for Shmuel when he was attacking the Amalekites. What was the flaw? That he didn't kill Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Those were problems, and he suffered for those problems. But the real character flaw was that he blamed his failure on David instead of accepting it on himself. And if he simply said, I am the problem, and I need to work on myself, he would have gone down in history as virtually unflawed. He would have been the hero of the book, instead of landing up being the pathetic character of the book, the saddest, one of the saddest characters of Jewish history, one of the saddest biblical characters, is Shaul, this magnificent human being who rises to the top and falls through nothing but his own flaw that he fails to recognize, focusing all of his anger on David. I want to pause for just a few moments. If there are any major questions from people who thought about it during the week, I don't want questions from people who haven't thought about the shiur the whole week and now I just remembered what I said last week and I've got a question. I want to go for a question from people who've been troubled by anything during the week because it was a troubling shiur. And the other thing I would be really interested in hearing is if anybody has used the shiur during the week. It's quite interesting that when I give shiurim, and I imagine the same applies to anybody else who gives shiurim, there is a tendency when people come to me afterwards with comments or questions, to come to me with comments and questions that are sometimes very fascinating, but they revolve around the person finding a similar idea somewhere else, and does this connect to that, and he once heard this, and he once heard that. Those aren't the questions I'm really intrigued by. The questions I'm really intrigued about, the comments that I'm really intrigued by, are the comments that deal with the application of the principle in real life. Where a situation where a person has been successful in using a principle, or hasn't. But a person comes to me after a shiur and says, now that I can use in the following way. This is what I plan to do with it. This is what I tried to do with it and couldn't. Or I don't know what the relevance of that shiur was. I don't know what one can do with it. Those are the questions that are important. I think do you need anything? Can I get you anything? Okay, please sit down. What's the most important part of Torah learning is the potential, the capacity of that learning to have impact on one's life. And that I'm really interested in hearing. If anybody has taken these principles and used them and dealt in life with them, that's important to share with people because that's where Torah becomes valuable. Torah is not valuable as an intellectual exercise. It's interesting as an intellectual exercise. But it's valuable when it enriches. It's valuable when it changes. So if there anybody who has a question on the shiur or wants to give an example of its application, that's something that would be good to hear. Sure. Anybody?
I had a question. Shaul was told by Shmuel that he was going to lose the kingdom.
Yes.
And he was basically begging Shaul, it looked like he was begging Shmuel not to tell people that he was going to lose the kingdom. He seemed to be falling at that point in time. And David came up much, I don't know how much later, but quite a bit later. You just had stated that Shaul's fault was that he eyed David. And I'm just wondering if he eyed David as a result of the depression he was already in. In other words, had he become depressed because he lost his job, so to speak, because he would be embarrassed in front of the people. And David came up.
First time we see reference to becoming depressed is here. There's been no earlier reference to it. That he felt regret, that he felt concern, that he felt remorse, that yes. But the first time we're introduced to depression is here, after he was over and was David.
So it's the external
influencing the internal. It's his choice to blame the competitor that causes his downfall. Once you start blaming your competitor, I'm not talking about in a business sense necessarily at all. Once you're blaming somebody out there who threatens you for your problems, you're overs. It's as simple as that. And it's just the easiest, the most comfortable thing to put the blame out there. The moment you do that, more growth is finished. That's the biggest danger. And it's the thing that we most naturally do. So we have to be counterintuitive in that whole process. Okay?
I don't understand how Shaul doesn't see the flaw in his own character. I mean, Shaul clearly had the power to make him, to relate to him that he would be king. How is it when he tells him he's not going to be king, that Shaul doesn't take the time at that point to find the graceful way out and do the right thing? He sees these events coming and making him less. How is it, what's he missing that, you know, he doesn't perceive his own downfall or his own lessening?
I think that's an important question, and I think that all we can really say in dealing with it, and it doesn't satisfy the question completely, is that taking a character as noble as Shaul and seeing that happen to him is the most critical danger signal to ourselves. What is he missing? He's missing nothing. Just the enormous human potential, the human tendency not to take responsibility for oneself. It's easier to take responsibility for everybody else. A person who's commanding a troop in the battle, he can take responsibility for everybody. A chief executive who's leading an organization, he can take responsibility for everybody. It's easier to take responsibility for the whole world than it is to take responsibility for oneself and say, this is my problem, I did it.
So what I don't understand is he didn't want that responsibility, and he kind of just walked up and says, come here, you're going to be king. So why, when he's basically relieved of it, why does it say, you know, I didn't want this anymore?
Also, important question. Once somebody has got something, taking it away from him is loss. No matter how little he might have wanted it to start with, taking something away is downward movement. We cannot tolerate downward movement. We can only tolerate. We thrive when we move forward. We deteriorate when we move backwards. And whether we wanted to be where we are or not is irrelevant to the fact that once we are there, a backward movement is painful. A backward movement is loss. And there are many such cases of great people who got to positions of greatness not because they wanted it at all, but once they were there, they hang on. And that was given legitimacy. He's not criticized for that. He's not criticized for desiring to hang on to the kingdom. He's criticized for the way he hangs on to it and his treatment of David. His perception of David is the cause of the problem. Yeah.
Your observation that the imitator tends to be more generous is interesting. I've never heard anything like it. I mean, would you think of it as a broad generality? But historically, would you say that ancient Rome was more generous than Greece after they stole all their arms?
I haven't analyzed it statistically or historically, but merely logically and ideologically, that one tends to be more generous with things that you didn't toil for. It's easier to give away somebody else's money than your own. I imagine that's the case. I mean, if the example, I'm sure there are examples where it isn't the case. I'm sure one cannot generalize. But okay, then let's move into the second phase of this chapter. Now, interestingly, sometimes the life lesson comes from the text itself, and sometimes, as in today's example, the life lesson comes from the material I need to learn with you so that you understand the text. I'm going to read through the text with you because the text is not able to be understood. I'm then going to have to explain some halakhic background to you. Those of you who have been with me in the Monday evening Gemara Shiur will be familiar with that background. But we'll share it with everybody and then understand the text again. And that background provides great richness to one's understanding. The area that we have to look at is chapter 18, verse 16. I'm going to read the Hebrew and do my own translation. You'll be able to pick it up in your English. B'chol Yisrael v'Yehuda ohev es David, and all of Israel and Yehuda loved David. A word that isn't used that often, certainly in a political context or a national context. They loved him. Ki hu yotze yovo lifnehem, for he would go out and come before them. V'yomer Shaul el David, and Shaul said to David, Hinei viti hagedoylo Merav. Behold, I have an elder daughter called Merav. She I will give to you as a wife. So King Saul is now offering his daughter Merav to David. You remember when David came and Goliath was there, people were saying the king has offered his daughter and great wealth to anybody who can kill the giant. David killed the giant, and there hasn't been any discussion about marriage or wealth subsequently until now. Shaul says, here's my daughter, my only daughter Merav. Ach bat, heyeli levin chayel, be a courageous son to me. Ve'elochem l'chamos Hashem, and fight the battles of God. In other words, there's a condition. Become my son-in-law, but be courageous. I want you to lead my armies into battle. The Shaul Amar, what was going on in Shaul's mind, bear in mind my introduction, this is a great, great man. What was going on deep in his subconscious? Shaul doesn't say this. Shaul might not even have known this. But we're told this. Deep in his subconscious, Al Tehi Yodi Bei, Utehi Bei Yad Plishtim, I will not kill him. Let the Philistines do the job. So while he's offering him this honor of leading the army, deep in his subconscious is, and may he die doing that. Vayomer David el Shaul, and David says to Shaul, Mi anochi mi chayai, who am I and what is my life worth? Mishpachas aviv Yisrael, the family of my father in Israel, we're not from a noble family, we're not from a great background. I am descended from Ruth the Moabite, I have no money, I have no status. But I will be with King Samuel. So there's a questioning of his own worth in that sense. And there's no sense that David is being anything but genuine in that questioning. How do I fit into the royal household? I don't feel part of that. I don't feel that I have the status and the nobility to be part of that scene. And so while these discussions are going backwards and forwards, he's reticent. And it was while these discussions and negotiations were in progress, she decided to marry Adriel as a wife. So she got fed up with the negotiations and she accepted a proposal from Adriel and she became his wife. Very interesting discussion with Gemara, which I'm going to do with you, is what exactly was the status between her and David? At what point of the negotiations did this happen? There was a view that they were married already. So we'll need to examine that. But have Michal Bashoel as David. But Michal, another daughter of Shaul, is the one who really loved David. Who says there's no romance in the Tanakh? Vayagidu Shaul, and they told Shaul, you know that your daughter is in love with David. Vayishar David Be'emav, and he liked the idea. Made good political sense. Vayomer Shaul, and Shaul said, verse 21, Et mena loy, I will give her to him, utehi lo lamokesh, and she will be his stumbling block. Through her, I'll get a David. Utehi bo yad plishtim, and at the end, the Philistines will bring him down. We'll see how. Vayomer Shaul el David b'shtayim tischatim bi hayom. And Shaul says to David, I'm going to translate it literally first, through two, you will be married to me this day. Implying that he was married to Merav, and now he's marrying Michal. Rashi and Unchlus and others make it clear that what Shaul is saying is, through one of the two, you're going to be my son-in-law. It didn't work out with Merav, but with Michal it's going to work out. One way or another, you're marrying into my family. But there is that connotation which we're going to deal with, that there was actually a marriage to Merav. Vayetzav Shaul es avadov, and Shaul instructed his servant, saying, Dabru el David, balot, secretly talk to David, vayelomer, and say to him, Hinei chofetz b'cho amerech, the king likes you, v'chol avodov ahivucha, and all of his servants love you. So there's already intrigue, there's already dishonesty in the relationship. Be'atoa now, hischatim b'melech, you should marry into his family, it's such a lovely family, and I love you so much, why are you hesitating? And they did it. The servants of Shaul spoke to David, which I don't know all these words. David, and David said, is this a simple matter? You're just telling me to marry into the king's home? Do you know what that is? And I am a lowly and a poor man. Now he didn't mention poverty before with Merav. Now he mentions poverty. An interesting point which we will have a look at. Yidra Avdei Shaul, the servants of Shaul said, look, we've tried to persuade him, but he says his prayer is, this is too big an issue for him. This is what David said. Shaul says, go back to David and tell him the following. The king wants no dowry. 100 foreskins of Philistines will satisfy him. Go and kill 100 Philistines and bring me their foreskins as proof that you've done that. In order to agree the enemy to avenge the enemies of the king. And once again we're told that was in Shaul's intent to have David killed by the Philistines. The Philistines aren't exactly going to invite him in to remove their foreskins. And they will be so angered by it, they will see such a degradation in David's actions. David will do it out of love. So he'll go and do this stupid thing, an idiotic thing, go into battle, not to capture territory. What was this battle about? So, you know, the first battle was about ideology, and the second one was about territory, and the third one was about oil, and the fourth one was about nuclear power, and the fifth one was about foreskin. And it's absolutely absurd. Why would he do such a thing? He's in love with Michal, says Shaul to himself. The Philistines will be furious, and they'll take good care of him. And the servants told David these things, not what was going on in his mind, of course, but what he said. David is still fairly naive. David hasn't become involved in the intrigue and in politics yet. He's a shepherd boy. He agrees to marry the king. And the days were not even fulfilled that Shaul had set him to bring him the 100 foreskins. David gets up. And he takes a few men. He kills 200 Philistines. And he brings 200 foreskins. And sends them to the king. And marries him to the king's home. And the king gives him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. And Shaul is watching this and sees that God is with David. And the worst part was, Michal really loved him. That was going to make things more complicated for a king. And Shaul continued to fear David even more. And from that time, Shaul became an enemy of David for all his days. Let's stop there. What we want to analyze is the two daughters. What were these relationships and what were the foreskins, and why wasn't he poor? He said for Michal, but he wasn't poor for Nalav, and why is he so reticent? And for that I need to indulge you in some Talmudic background. In the Monday evening Gemara Shiur, we're learning the tractate of Kiddushin. When we started this tractate, I explained what the word Kiddushin means. Kiddushin means sanctity, holiness. So now imagine the scene. If I tell you, I'm going to, and if you know anything about what Kiddushin deals with, just set that aside. Make your minds blank. You come to me and you say, I want to learn, I've heard about this magnificent thing called the Talmud. That which contains all of human wisdom. I want to study it. And I say, sure, we'll start with tractate Kiddushin. Fine. What does Kiddushin mean? It's about sanctity. Wonderful. What's in your mind? We're going to be dealing with God, with sanctity, with mysticism, with the temple, the service Kiddushin. How to sanctify one's life, how to elevate one's life, spirituality. Great stuff. Let's start. So right, first phrase, this is how it starts. First word, Ha'isha, a woman. What is this about? Women or sanctity? The Masechta, the tractate that starts, the word that starts, the tractate of Kiddushin, starts with Ha'isha, a woman. Second word is Nikmes, is purchased. Ishvesha Drachim, in one of three ways. Now we're into buying women. What is this? This is sanctity. And then I explain to you, well, it doesn't mean buying women, it means marrying women. When you marry a woman, that's what it means. And you say, right? And so why does it say buy? Why does it use that word? Why does it say when a man marries a woman? Well, a man can marry a woman with three mechanisms. next one you say to me is, what are the three mechanisms? We're now talking about marriage. Okay, so I thought we were going to be learning about sanctity. We're learning about relationships instead. Okay, we like relationships too. So let's hear about relationships. First thing is, we don't like this. The first thing we're told about a relationship is a man buys a woman. What are the three ways? With money? Those are the elements. A man marries a woman. What's the mechanism? How does a relationship start with a woman? So at the beginning of the tractate of Kiddushin, a relationship with a woman starts with money. This is the Torah. Or bishtara with a legal document, or bavir with sex. It's one of the three. That's how a relationship starts. And that's called purchasing, acquiring. What this means, and we can't go into a great deal of detail, but to give you some kind of insight into the information and knowledge you need for an understanding of this section, is that niknes does not mean acquire in the simple sense of the word. Niknes means acquire by means of investment. Yes, a man needs to acquire a woman. Acquire doesn't mean to own her. Acquire means to gain her. Acquire means to get her. To do something that makes a connection. There's something he's actually going to get of hers. And he does that by means of kinyan, which is an investment. And there are three ways to invest in a woman, we're taught. What are the three ways? First is kesef, money. We'll come back to that in a moment. The second is shtar. Shtar means a legal document, and that means communication. That means verbally, using words. And the third is bio, which means sexually, physically. So there are three ways to initiate a relationship with a woman. And in those days there was an assumption that a relationship with a woman was leading to marriage. So whether it says the three ways to marry a woman or to initiate a relationship with a woman was the same thing. There needs to be verbal communication or physical communication or financial investment. Those are the three ways. Now we use all three. Legally we use all three, and sociologically we use all three. But it's interesting which is the first one and which is the one we really use. The very first one that is used is money. If you want to establish a relationship with a woman, what do you need? Money. That's where you start. Not a nice face, not good yichus and parents, you need money. That's where you do it. What is the role of this money? What's it going to do? And what do we actually do under the chuppah? Takes a ring out of his pocket. You know, it doesn't have to be a ring. As long as it's gold. We make a big thing about the ring. The ring is unimportant. It's symbolic. What is important is the value. That has to be currency. That has to be exchangeable, marketable value. And what he's doing under that chuppah, if you strip away all the romance, what he's doing is, he's saying, I want to marry you, and here's the money. If you accept the money, I'm assuming you're agreeing to marry me. She accepts it, she'll marry it. That's what happens under the chuppah. Nothing else. That's all that happens under the chuppah. The sheva brachos and this and that. All of that is peripheral to the actual event. The event is, here's the money, accept it and you're married. Let me explain when we learn the Gemara what that means and the role of all of that. What is the very first interaction that a man and a woman have if they want to go out on a date? The very first interaction is not the conversation they have, that's contrived. It's unnatural, it's stiff, they don't know each other, it's artificial. So they go out somewhere. They go out for a cup of coffee, they go out for supper, they go out somewhere. The moment of tearing is when the check comes. That says all. That's all she has to look at. She can ignore the entire discussion. She can ignore the whole lot. All she needs to look at is, what's the relationship here? What's the relationship when it comes to money? Is this a man who's willing to put his hand in his pocket for the relationship? Or does he just want a good time provided it doesn't cost him much? The money tells that more than anything else. Because money is the only thing that you... Money, by money I don't mean cash necessarily, I mean value. Money is the only thing you do for somebody else that actually costs you. When you spend money on somebody else, you are poorer financially. So you will only do that if you regard yourself as becoming richer emotionally. So if you take a girl out and you're not willing to invest money in her, what you say is, I want a good time with you, but I'm not willing to pay. Well, she'll be an idiot if she agreed. But there are idiots in the world, and some agree. What about the woman paying? Why doesn't she have to pay? No, says the Torah. You invest in her. She responds. But the investment is from the man. Money plays an important part, not only in the initiation of the relationship, but in the sustenance of the relationship. And again, I'm using money in the broadest sense of the willingness to take a loss because the reward is greater. And that's the generosity that keeps the relationship going. And then yes, there needs to be verbal communication, and there needs to be sexual and physical communication. Those three things need to be in place. One of them falls away, the relationship is fractured. Which is the first one that usually falls away? Money. That's very often where the first problems arise. The meanness of one of the parties, and very often it's the man. The unwillingness of the man to be generous with his time, with his assets, with his money, to be really, really generous. That's where the typing starts, and then the relationship starts going in all sorts of funny ways. But sometimes it's the others that go off track. Now, the Gemara deals with an interesting question. What about, I go through all sorts of intriguing cases of different types of money and different types of value, and if it's not gold, and if it's, he uses his watch, or he uses a pen, or he uses property, or he uses shares in the stock market, all sorts of different issues. The one case the Gemara goes through is, what if he uses a loan? If he says, you owe me money, forget it, under the chuppah. Now, I'm standing there, I'm the rabbi, I say, do you have a ring? He says, no, I don't have a ring, I don't need a ring. Excuse me? Who told you you don't need a ring? He says, I'm going to Mori Kiddushin. She owes me $100. So I'm going to say under the chuppah, with the $100 that you already have of mine, you don't have to repay it. Let that $100 be the amount I'm investing in you, and if you agree, you are my wife. No reason why that shouldn't work. He's losing $100 over the deal. But it doesn't work. So the Gemara, that doesn't work. Why not? Explains the Rambam. Because when he lent her the money, the intention was to spend it. So he gave her $100 2 weeks ago. We must assume that $100 she spent. And she doesn't have the pleasure of receiving something new under the chuppah. So this investment, you now get a new dimension on this investment. When you give her something under the chuppah, it must be something she didn't have a moment ago. Now it's true that she had a loan and now you've forgotten the loan, she doesn't have to pay it back. But she didn't actually receive anything. Or put a different way, you didn't pay anything out to you. There's a very big difference between, in generosity, between waiving a loan, a book entry, and actually putting your hands in your pocket and making a new investment. There's an emotional difference. There's not an arithmetic difference, but there is an emotional difference. So you owe me $100, arithmetically, if I say keep the $100, or I say no, repay me the $100, and here's a gift of the $100. Emotionally, those are two completely different things. And from a relationship perspective, they're different. Let me give you another example. I'm going to somebody for dinner tonight. Oh my goodness, I need to give them a gift. I forgot. What have you got in the house? Well, last week somebody came to us and gave us a box of chocolates. Let's wrap it up and give them a box of chocolates. Well, arithmetically, that's fine. It's an asset that I have and I'm giving it away as a present. It's not the same as going out this afternoon and saying, what would they like? What do I think they would enjoy? Arithmetically, it's the same. Relationship-wise, it's not the same. So to sanctify a woman, to invest in a woman under the chuppah with stale money, doesn't work. It needs to be fresh money. It needs to be something fresh that she didn't have before. It's not just a value issue. It's not just transferring an asset. It's not a book entry. It's putting your hands in your pockets and giving her something additional to that which she has up until this moment. And as we discussed in the Monday night Gemara shiurim, that's not just a one-off thing. That's the continuous mode of the relationship that one is doing that continuously. Now, with that halakhic background, we can understand the Gemara's analysis in a completely different case of this strange piece of Shmuel. The Gemara asks the following question and says, Nasa David Shtei Achayos B'chayehem. How did David marry two daughters, two sisters, while they were both alive? It's against the law. It's true, Yaakov married two sisters, but that wasn't by design, and that was before the Torah was given. But now you can't marry two sisters. If you've married a woman, you can't marry a sister. And David married Merav and Michal. So we see right away that there was an assumption in the Gemara that at some point he was married to Merav. But there was actually a marriage. What happened? The Gemara assumes that when Shaul said, "Here is Merav, I'm giving her to you as a wife," that although David said, "Who am I and am I worthy of it?" No, it doesn't matter. He agreed and he did it. The answer is, two answers are given. One answer is Michal achar mitat Merav nosom. He only married Michal after Merav died. But Yeshua ben Kocho, no, the second view is Kiddushei Toos Hayulo b'Merav. He thought he was betrothed to Merav, but he wasn't. How does that happen? Remember that between betrothal and marriage, most times there was a year. So what we do under the chuppah today used to take place, and a year later the couple would live together. So one thing is for sure, Merav and David never lived together. But did he marry her? Did he give her money under the chuppah? Did he give her a ring? And how can there be any doubt about this? The Gemara goes through various proofs and says, what was the mistake? So the Gemara, if you remember, Shaul said, whoever kills Goliath, I will give great wealth to. Has he ever paid David? We have no record of the payment being made. So at this point, Shaul owes David a lot of money. It's a bet. Ozal Kaple, David killed Goliath and got the debt. Omar Loi, Milve Idlach Gabai. All that David possessed in the world, he was a very poor man. But now he was wealthy. The king owed him a fortune. So when he married Merav, what did he use to betroth her? He said, Shaul, every penny you owe me is hers. And with that, I sanctify her. So Shaul later on, ha ha ha, the money is hers, but she's not your wife. You've forgotten the debt, but you don't know the Gemara and Kiddushin and the Rambam, that you can't use a debt to marry a woman. You've got to use fresh money, and you don't have any fresh money. But don't worry, there's Michal still to come. And he gave Merav to Abiel. What do we see here? We see a man, Shaul, doing amazing things. At least we can take the view of Rashi and the Targum that Merav was never married to him, that they were negotiating over Merav, and Merav, who had then become post-bat mitzvah, was entitled to marry herself off and did so without Shaul even knowing. That's the one view. We can take that view and it's comfortable. But it's important to know there is another view. But there was a great deal of intrigue and nastiness taking place here, and manipulation of the law to leave David in a strange situation. But that view that I've just explained to you gives us an understanding of the last verse we learned. Vayar Shaul vayedo ki Hashem im David. Shaul saw and he knew that God was with David. Why? Because Michal bat Shaul ahavatu. Because Michal was the one who loved him. So with all the intrigue, what landed up? Merav didn't want to marry David. And he would have been quite happy to have had David married to a wife, his daughter, who didn't love him. Because then through his daughter, he could get a David. What landed up happening? Through this whole intrigue, David lands up marrying Michal. Still his daughter, but an ally of David. So now instead of having his own ally in David's house, sharing a bed with David, David now has a daughter of Shaul, a spy in Shaul's house. The whole table has been reversed. Instead of Shaul using his daughter as the way to get at David, Shaul suddenly realizes David has his daughter as a way of getting whatever information he needs about Shaul. And so Shaul realizes that God has turned this to David's advantage. With all Shaul's conniving and intrigue, this has turned out to be to David's advantage, not to Shaul's advantage. What do we see? We see firstly the elements that I mentioned to you that came from the background material needed in order to understand the shiur the concepts of investment in a woman and why a loan doesn't work. But there needs to be fresh giving all the time. Book entries don't work. It needs to be generosity with thought. It needs to be generosity with consciousness. It needs to be generosity with innovativeness. That's what generosity means, and that's what giving means. And that through a small error in calculation, Shaul manages to release himself from his financial indebtedness to David, and to release himself from his indebtedness to David in terms of the daughter that he's supposed to give her to marry. He's willing to give her a second daughter in the hope and the belief that through his second daughter he will be able to access David and bring about his downfall. That doesn't happen. Very often God allows us to do the things we want to do. The day of Sha'adam wrote to Lelech Melichim, so if we want something badly enough, passionately enough, God lets us have it, sometimes even if it's not good for us. And therefore we have to be careful with that passion sometimes. Be careful that what we're doing is not only because we want it, but also because it's right. But sometimes, when what we want and plan and implement doesn't fit into God's grand scheme, nothing we're going to do is going to make it happen. All the working, all the planning, all the implementation, not only doesn't it necessarily come to be, but God turns it around 180 degrees. And what we plan to be the downfall of another turns out to be the downfall of ourselves. Certainly when we're in that mode of meanness, when we view our competitors, whether our social competitors or our business competitors or our ideological competitors, when we view them as the source of our flaws, when we view them as being responsible for our downfall, when we are unwilling to look at ourselves and to deal with ourselves, and we invest energy in bringing them down, sooner or later that energy works against us. It doesn't bring them down, it brings us down. And that's what's important to know. At the end of the day, if we have the flaw, nothing but correcting that flaw is going to rectify our situation. No amount of blaming of anybody else is going to do it. And certainly no amount of politicking against anybody else and planning and plotting and scheming against anybody else is going to do it. On the contrary, that's going to demean us more and more. And here we see Shaul digging his own grave so pathetically. Every step Shaul takes is just digging his grave a little deeper, making life more unintolerable for himself, more intolerable for himself. And each time that happens, we can imagine what goes through his mind. There he goes, that David again, with his charm, he's captured Michal's heart. That villain. You're not the villain. Michal's not the villain. Shaul, you're the villain in this situation. Can't you see that? It's you who's doing it. You brought this about. You've created this situation, and only you can change it. But he won't change it. We will not look at ourselves. We will not take that responsibility. Man, as great as Shaul, has this one flaw that he can't overcome. The insistence on seeing that Shaul over Eyon was David. To look at David with that eye of malevolence, with that eye of meanness, with that eye of belief that whatever I'm doing wrong is caused by you. And if that's a change, we talk about the impact of Torah on the way we operate. If that's all we can take away from a shiur, is to look at ourselves and catch ourselves doing it. That's all. Just the kind of situation, this car that's in front of you, that's traveling at the speed limit and you miss the traffic light. And why is he so slow? Nothing's on him. He's fine. He's doing it okay. The little things like that to the major things in life. To just notice how frequently we look outside ourselves and pin the blame on somebody else. And just to change that process around. Not to become self-indulgent in self-guilt and what a terrible person I am and look what I am and look what I'm responsible for. And can't go that way either. The test is whether it paralyzes us or it energizes us. The moment we feel paralyzed by our guilt, then we're onto a sickness. We're onto a sick kind of guilt. When it's not a guilt, but it's a self-analysis, a self-criticism. That leads one to greater action. A criticism that says, what can I do to change? What can I do to get myself out of this? What can I do to make sure that this doesn't happen again? If that's what we trip ourselves up on, catch ourselves doing that, and just shift the emphasis. We find ourselves moving into phases of change, of improvement, and much greater happiness, escaping this depressiveness that comes upon people who see the whole world as the source of their trouble. Thank you.